IT businesses in Sacramento, California.
From somewhere deep in the cloud and the corners of the earth, this is the Killing It Podcast, with a focus on helping you make sense and dollars of all things IT, with your hosts, Dave Sobel, Ryan Morris, and Carl Polachuk.
Welcome to episode 101 of the Killing It,
Killing It Podcast.
God, you guys have lost your mojo. Like, we're going to have to mail in some mojo for you guys.
Well, so, you know, it's getting, it, I don't know, you play with the technology a little bit, you make some changes to this, you make some changes to that. Like, you know, it'll circle back around.
All right, so we're episode 101. We are now well on our way to 200 episodes. I just want to say that for the
record. We have rounded the corner. We see the future in sight. It's all but here.
Oh, it's totally coming.
So, yeah, and what's really fun is that we're not quite at 2 years, right? So we still have the two-year anniversary coming up. We have every excuse to just talk about ourselves.
Well, sure. Isn't that the whole point of hosting your own podcast too? Is that you can actually talk about yourselves a few times? Like,
and come on. In a world where everyone alive has started a new podcast in the coronavirus work from home total isolation world, the fact that everybody starts but then they give up after 3 or 4 episodes, 100 is legit. And honestly, I will say, in 100 episodes, you guys might have felt differently at certain points. I've never felt like there was a time where we were like, there's nothing to talk about this week. I'm like, my problem is always, I got 16 things I want to talk about. We've only got 30 minutes. Which ones do we prioritize?
Right. Well, I think folks don't realize, so we get together and we weed down what we want to talk about to 3 topics. And that's sometimes more difficult than doing the show.
It's true. We actually have to figure out what we're going to talk about. Maybe there's an after show sometime, or we do it live or something, like, where people actually get to see some of the sausage being
However, I will also say, those other podcasts out there in the world that do 2-hour episodes, man, their audience must love them, because I can't imagine listening to a 2-hour podcast.
I don't want to listen to myself for 2 hours.
Later. I know, please. I don't want to listen to me for that long. No, no, no. Well, today we're brought by Gazinta Mobius, the easiest way for ConnectWise Manage and QuickBooks Online to connect. Keep invoices, expenses, and inventory automatically updated right from Manage to QuickBooks Online, and payments right back into Manage. With simple pricing, set it and forget it auto sync, Gazinta Mobius delivers with no restrictions on the number of invoices, expenses, and payments, and plays well with others like Connect Booster. Trusted by over 1,000 MSPs, now including a free plan, go to gozinta.com/Mobius and tell them the guys from Killing It sent you.
Very cool. So, Ryan, what have we got on the show today?
So, we are going to dive in on our first topic. It is a review of some of the thinking around the State of the Channel survey, right? Published by our friends in the industry who do the research that we always want to be able to do. This is something that we take very seriously, and we always want to make sure we're giving you the latest and greatest on what's happening with you, with your peers around the industry. But our friends over at Channel Pro do this survey every year, try to talk to people about what's happening on the business side, where are they optimistic, where are they not. Many findings, obviously, in a weird and different year. I think there's probably 100 takeaways that most of us will come back and go, yeah, that's obvious, no kidding. But I want to get into some of the deeper things. So I'd love to get some of you guys' input and thoughts on what you took away from the State of the Channel. And there are many things that I'll get into here as we dive into our time. But what were your first takeaways on the state?
Well, you know, that one of their first things was that we're bruised but roaring back. I mean, that's kind of their headline. I gotta say, I'm not sure how bruised we are. I think our clients might have been bruised, but most IT professionals I talked about are doing very, very well, and didn't, you know, other than getting some of their sanity back, they didn't really feel like they had a real hit in 2020. So I think they're just all cruising right along.
I'm going to say it because I did say it on Business Tech when I did the analysis on this because I think it's an important point. If you went out of business, you did not respond to this survey. So there.
That's a good point.
I mean, look, so like there's a huge sampling problem of, well, yeah, we didn't measure anybody that disappeared. Now, because you can't just go to a group of people and say, like, how are you all doing? Well, these are all the survivors. You actually have to do an industry analysis to understand that. So what we can talk about this state of the channel probably is, okay, of the survivors, we know.
That's totally legit, although I have to say, because I run an online community, and yes, everybody who is a member is still in the business, but we didn't lose anybody because their business was down. Their business was having trouble. They were struggling in 2020.
Sure, but again, we have the same sample set problem of, well, yeah, Carl, but they're also engaged in building their business and at least some level probably have some execution bit to it. I mean, look, I've got data that also tells me my audience didn't necessarily get smaller, meaning they're investing in education. But I can't get over Forrester data from, you know, from pre-pandemic that said 25% of the market was running at break even or a loss. Like, again, I just don't have this data set doesn't tell me anything about that group. So I just am putting that aside and noting that, because when I did look at it and say, like, okay, you know, they say, it's coming roaring back. Okay, except 48% of the respondents canceled or delayed plans to hire new employees, right? And 19% laid off people. So the majority of these solution providers did not hire or let people go. So surviving, and I'm on board with survival. I'm on board with all of that. I just want to make sure that we're not reading this and all going, oh, it's all great. It's like, well, no, we didn't hire anybody. We delayed our expansion plans. Oh, and by the way, roughly 20% of the market let people go. Okay.
Which, by the way, we strenuously advised that you did not do unless it was an absolute last resort all the way back in March and April of last year, right? It is historically proven that it is very difficult to recover from a downturn in the market if your first action is to let go of your trained and capable staff and capacity. To rebuild that in the rebound is definitely going to hamstring your efforts. I go where you did, Dave, on this as a general takeaway. There are a lot of stories about upbeat on revenue and profit performance. There's, I believe, a number of technology categories that are highlighted here and that I've been tracking that are more essential to our customers and their basic business operations than ever before. Remote access, cloud capabilities, security. These are things that they're not just nice to haves anymore. They're, you absolutely must have it, and therefore our audience has become mission critical. However, the optimism versus pessimism I read as bravado. I don't see it in the actual execution and follow through. And we've been working on this, software vendor clients that we work with, individual solution providers. It is a rare day when somebody says growth is there, the market is healthy, your prospects are good. I will put my money where my mouth is and actually go hire additional humans to pursue this opportunity. We have one client in Southern California who has done this. And when I made the recommendation, this is what you need to do. Here's a full analysis of your business. Action number one is you need to hire new headcount. And they said, good, let's go. And they did it. Legitimately, offline, my reaction was, no kidding. They actually did it, because most of the people in this industry, that's the first red flag that I see. We will try hard. We will say that we're going to grow our business. But one of the lessons I learned a long time ago is growth ain't free. Growth costs money and more than just trying harder.
Right.
Not just promotions. It's not just tools that make you capable. There's humans, there's resources, there's cash money investments. I don't see that happening in the channel right now.
By the way, I want to say, like, there's also this, because I want to be careful on the way that I think of myself on this a lot too, is because I'm trying to rebel a little against this, about the eternal optimism. Like, there's too much, like, everything is amazing, the opportunity is huge, like. And I don't want the counter to that to be everything is horrible, the world is on fire. What I want to actually have is a conversation about the middle and the degrees of difficulty. So, for example, you know, I put up a lot of alarms as this all started because the data wasn't good. However, a lot of solution providers, based on some Dipple, like some data coming out of Paul Dipple's service leadership organization, showed that a lot of solution providers made corrective actions and got ahead of it, right? That's good. Now, are they looking at that and saying, like, oh, everything was amazing? No, what they're saying is the waters were rough. We navigated through a difficult 2020. And so you're in that middle bit. It's like, okay, it wasn't disastrous. It could have been a whole lot worse. There was some good execution there. And now we're navigating still choppy waters, not entirely knowing what the recovery is. And that's where I kind of rebel against the, it's coming roaring back. No, it might actually just be rough and we got to get through that, meaning we're getting to the other side. Oh, by the way, we're not as impacted as other industries, so we'll look relatively good. That's this middle bit. It's okay to talk about the middle bit.
So I will just say, because we're pretty much out of time on this, everything is truly amazing, and we've never had more opportunity than we do today. So, you know, a lot of us, including the three of us on this show, started this recession by saying, okay, just so you know, here's what you do during a recession. You conserve your cash, you take a deep breath, you pause for a minute, you don't make big decisions. And to the extent that people took that advice, some of them may have been the people who laid people off, anticipating things would actually be a little bit rougher than they turned out to be. So,
see, and I will say one final note here, because you guys have heard me talk about this before. Where do you expect your profit growth to come from in 2021? Let's ring the bell for low-code, no-code, custom application development. That's a phenomenal upside opportunity right now, and almost none of the audience that has historically listened to us does that, because that's not about monitoring and management. That's about creating, and that's a fundamentally different business. Waters are great, but you got to learn to do new things.
And that's a whole other topic.
And topic number two flows right from that. Something else that nobody else in our audience is doing is building houses with 3D printing.
Yet.
So, great, great story came out late last week, about this company in New York that is 3D printing houses. And these are not little, you know, mini houses. These are the real deal. 1,500 square feet, $300,000, and it's made out of 3D printed concrete. I don't know how much that printer costs, but the guy says, and we will put a link here to the story, but dude says he has thousands of people lined up to buy houses. And this isn't just a demo for promotional purposes. This is the model home for an entire neighborhood that is now licensed to be built starting immediately.
I mean, let's put it in the, well, that's cool. like you got to start with it. I mean, part of me is looking at this and going, saying, like, okay, so now every home can truly be custom built, and like custom to order, yet completely standardized, in that you like sort of, you just design it, you send the machine out there, and then it prints it up and you have a house. It's like, that is super cool. It's both the best of standardization and the best of customization at the same time.
Which is the fundamental promise of 3D printing, right? If you took this from a component level, pieces and parts for your washing machine level, industrial applications, rapid prototyping in architecture and design firms, it's one standard process to create any custom output, and it's the software prototyping in between that makes this happen. Writ large, on a 1,500 square foot house level, I've been a dork about how cool 3D printing is for several years. I think it's phenomenal potential and upside, and not for, as Dave has pointed out to us in the past, things that would be more economically manufactured at scale in China. This is for things you do not wish to ship from here to there. And that, there's a lot of use cases there, right? This use case, an actual dwelling that says, I don't like square walls and 90-degree angles. I want this thing to be utterly fluid and have angles and curves and whatever. And usually in the housing business, they look at you and go, shut up, that's not realistic. You can't do that. In the 3D printed house world, you can have whatever you want. I think this is very, very cool.
I can imagine an entire industry growing up around, you know, we're going to put this mod kit onto your house, right? You know, it's like when you take a Volkswagen and you make it look like a Rolls Royce, right? I want the house that we do this. So we got these bolt-ons for this and that. And, you know, how do you punch through a wall that's 3 inches of concrete times two layers? Well, somebody's got an app for that, right? And then, but if you want to say that this is where the plumbing goes and this is where the washing machine goes or whatever, I could see a total industry growing up on making these houses a little more usable, a little more normal, a little more friendly. Because I got to say, concrete, it's tough to be hanging pictures on that wall.
Well, but let's also talk about the time to market on this. So the other thing that's interesting is it requires very little labor to build. The price is low. And by the way, you do it in like 2 days. I mean, it's
right,
super efficient from a productivity perspective. Like, again, Ryan's right. I've been rebelling against this kind of vagary idea of like, oh, I'm 3D printing everything. It's like, okay, no, but these cool specialized cases, yes, I get it. Like, right, this guy's spending a lot of money on a very custom printer that is designed for this particular solution, and then it opens up that, yeah, I'm on board. This makes tons of sense to me.
Well, and see, think about this from a business model point of view. The addressable audience is phenomenally large. The customization, specialization skills that would allow you to charge premium prices are very sustainable, and the barrier to entry, like Carl said this earlier, I can't imagine how much that printer costs, but I'm assuming that it's not just something for a weekend hobbyist to go out and go, I'm in the concrete home building business now too. It's probably going to cost millions to get in, but I mean, you think about this, right? Standard housing applications, there's a lot of opportunity here in being able to build not just customized but sustainable dwellings. But think about it in like emergency and disaster relief type applications. I now have suddenly 10,000 people who used to have a house and now they don't, and I need to be able to do this. Well, you know, right now FEMA will ship in a bunch of shipping trailers and take forever to do a really poor substandard job. But if I could just go deploy a handful of these things to a disaster site, I don't have to build them to the specs of it's gonna last forever, but I could build them to the specs of let's put 10,000 people under a roof as quickly and economically as possible. But I think you could make some money doing this.
I don't know what it takes to ship one of these printers, because the printer's got to be bigger than the house, right?
Got to have a custom Air Force helicopter.
You mentioned specs, and I have to say, if you've ever built something like a prefab addition to your house or whatever, and you buy these plans that have been approved in every state in the nation, but then you got to take them down to your local person to say, oh, I need your approval, they always make stupid little changes. And it's like the size of a bolt, like, oh, I need that bolt to be a quarter inch longer, even though no one's ever going to see it. And it's been structurally approved in 50 states. That's the power of the local enforcer, right? That one person, his job is to make your life difficult. And so with luck, they won't have the same kind of issues when they decide to move this house out of the state of New York and into another subdivision.
Well, you know, again, I think this, it's these are interesting business problems that can be solved. You know, there's opportunity there because,
right.
but there is, I mean, you can see even benefits there, right? I could submit the plans for review, complete visualization showing exactly what it's gonna, I don't have as much, if the machine's doing it, there's a potential for higher precision. Like there is an upside for the regulators too on this, you know, to actually do that. So I it'll be interesting to see that play itself out over time.
Well, and not for nothing, our audience, there is a local service provider angle on anything associated with 3D printing. Because as soon as you put a capability remote and local, whether it's 3D printing or, you know, getting off of the cloud and putting local equipment into an on-premises environment, you take capability and make it local, and now it needs local support and technical capabilities. Imagine the business impact and their lost revenue if one of these things goes offline for a minute. I mean, if the machine breaks, I get it, somebody has to turn a wrench, but in our world, I would envision that most of the hiccups to productivity are going to be software related. And the construction industry doesn't have a whole lot of reputation for patience with software problems. I think that they may demand that a local service provider come with this thing. That sounds like a cool opportunity.
And well, I would a final note on this, like to say, let's put one in the win column. We've been talking about 3D printing houses, you know, and buildings. Maybe, I didn't look it up, but since episode 2 or 3. So this is finally one that we can say, all right, now that's real. Let's move on. What's next?
Right. Called it. So in from one side of the world to the other, let's talk about what's going on in Australia. So obviously the Australian government has looked at, has put in place as of this recording, a new law that requires there to be payments to news publishers from Facebook and Google. And the law is specifically targeted on Facebook and Google. Although during the amendment process, it is now open up to be reviewed for other organizations at a later date, and additionally to review existing agreements. So there is a potential that this will go larger. What's interesting about this particular case is, so this is backed and been pushed heavily by the Murdoch News Corporation over time. And as it got rolled out, the fine folks at Google decided to pay up, and the folks at Facebook fought back and for a while actually shut down news entirely on the feeds for a period of time, which resulted in a considerable amount of chaos as they went pretty hard with that slam hammer, may blocking some government sites, and in one case at least blocking themselves at least once. So there's been a lot of, you know, a lot of discussion about this. I've got a particular opinion on this, but before I dive in onto that, guys, what were your reactions to the moves in Australia?
So I will tell you, as somebody who was involved in what we now call the internet, before it was called the internet, and involved in a news organization putting things online when it was in the world of dial-up, I, from day one, thought that the news industry misunderstood the internet and missed every opportunity placed in front of them. I do pay for, I don't know, probably 6 different news organizations, you know, like Wired and New York Times and some others. But I pay less than I would pay to get my local newspaper delivered to my doorstep. And my local newspaper still wants me to get it delivered to my doorstep, and I haven't in 20 years. So, you know, it's an odd thing that an online, a wire-based industry completely missed the internet. And now they're saying, hey, wait a minute, we bring value and you should be paying for it. And it's like, it's hard to change the rules of the game. Although I think they deserve some money for that. On the other hand, we'll come back to this. I also have the complex opinion that Google and Facebook will rip off anybody anytime if they have the opportunity.
Well, and see, that's where I begin the analysis. Number one, content creators should actually be compensated for the things that they create, and the industry fundamentally flubbed that in their business model adaptation, like you're saying, Carl. Going forward, I believe that it would never have come back as a possibility if Google, Facebook, etc., they're not the only ones by any means, had not become so blatantly predatory with the way that they are trying to just eliminate the business model for content creation and move all of the value to ad-supported aggregation. I have a problem with that as a basic business model. And what I was curious and just slightly optimistic to witness while this was happening was for the number of days that Facebook shut themselves down and said, no, we're going to take our ball and go home, the number one download on the Apple App Store and on Google, etc., the number one download was for the app for a local news channel in Australia. And I was like, wait a second, you mean there's an alternative to Facebook as a place to get your news? There might actually be a source that's not aggregated where you could go and pay for access to legitimate content that you wanted to get. That was really a sign of life I didn't anticipate, and it was something that I thought was a really potentially positive development in this process. And then Facebook came back, they negotiated, they agreed to a settlement somewhere in the middle, which we still don't know what that outcome of terms and conditions are, and then they came back. I think honestly, Facebook said, slam hammer, we're going to turn you people off. And the world said, you know, information and life will find a way. And they went around Facebook and still got their headlines. Honestly, I think there was a day at Facebook headquarters where they went, oh, crap, people have realized they can get what they need without going through us. We have to get back online. That's a bright day for the interweb.
Well, so I will borrow liberally from Professor Galloway on this one because it summed up for me so well. In a battle between News Corp and Facebook and Google, I am just rooting for the bullets. Like, it's there's just like, come on, I can't get behind either side of this. Now, I take the step back and I go, look, Carl's right in that the industry missed on this. But they do deliver some value that we need to have. By the way, there's only value in aggregation if there's content being created, right? You have to create content to aggregate it, right? So there is clearly value in there. And by the way, these two particular predatory companies have completely figured out a way to monetize this and become incredibly powerful on this. In Facebook's case, in such a way that one single human being who cannot be removed has absolute control over what gets decided. I mean, there's cases where he has specifically stepped in and changed policy because of his own whims. I'm pointing right to the Alex Jones decisions. There's coverage on that where he stepped in against policy and changed it on his own. That's not the way this is intended to go, right? Like, one person is not intended to have that much power in aggregation. The flip side of that is I'm not particularly keen on a law that, you know, backed by one Australian conglomerate, which is where News Corp comes from, you know, strong arming these companies to force them into paid arbitration if it can't work it out. This is not the right solution. That does not mean the problem isn't legit.
Right.
We well, have and to figure out a solution to this.
Just a note, on the other side of the world, Europe, the European Union, has always said, look, you guys want to play? Here are the rules. And has had a whole different set of rules. The U.S. has been mostly hands off of these corporations. But a lot of the world says, hey, you know, if you want to put your stuff up, you got to pay him. Right?
Well, to be fair, we get the benefits. Like, Americans, the U.S. economy, we get the most of the jobs, we get the stock bounces, we get the economic drivers of this that make us better. Like the Europeans, the Australians, they just get much more of the negative side of this. By the way, you add in Europe, like watching Microsoft go say, you know, I think the Europeans really ought to put this in too, and we back it, is delightfully funny to watch Microsoft go, yeah, let's we've got Bing, everybody. Like, and watch them poke at these pieces themselves. Like there are big players on all sides that are trying to influence a real problem. Like, we have to recognize that there is a core problem necessary to be solved here. The market alone is not solving it. We've got to solve, but I'm not sure, but this is not going to be the way that this should play out.
See, and that's exactly where I came at when I was noodling this for our prep process. I was like, listen, I believe fundamentally that content matters and creators need to be rewarded. I believe that the market cannot, will not regulate itself in this situation. And it is unreasonable for a company like Facebook, Google, etc., to assume that the whole wide world should just be open for their whim and there should be absolutely no rules, which led me to a conclusion of, you remember that thing we talked about a year or so ago about the SplinterNet? That one, again, Dave, put that in the column of called it, because it's coming, because this is something that needs to be resolved. There needs to be an answer to reward creators but still provide access, and it will never come to one version of, well, this is the correct way to regulate or intermediate or aggregate any of this stuff in every single country across the globe. It cannot happen.
By the way, I'll close out with, and by the way, we do have a bias as three content creators sitting around. We would like to get paid for our work.
Yes, but see, that's the thing, right? Be good enough to create content that people will pay for, to borrow another piece of Professor Galloway's religion, on a subscription, right? Like, that. If what you do is good, people will pay for it, and either in advertising or direct subscriptions. But there's no way this is going to get resolved one flavor in every country on every continent. This is an internal phenomenon that will bring us to the reality of the SplinterNet.
Very good. And we will return to this topic another time. But now, that's it for episode 101 of the Killing It Podcast. Much better.
Thanks for tuning in to the Killing It Podcast. Please share with your friends and tell everyone to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, and all the podcast places. Join us next week and help us keep killing it in the technology business.